Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and at this moment when drug overdoses are the number one cause of accidental deaths in the United States, surpassing car accidents, addiction is still often framed as one of two things, a crime or a disease. But maybe it's neither. My next guest, Maya Salovitz, is a leading journalist covering neuroscience and addiction, and she says it's more accurate to think of addiction as a learning disorder. Her new book is Unbroken Brain, a revolutionary new way of understanding addiction. Maya, hi. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here.
And the conventional wisdom for many people who are weary of the war on drugs is to say that addiction, like obesity, is a disease. Why do you think that view is either too simplistic or misguided?
It's too simplistic, and it has also led to a sort of weird mix of morality and medicine. So we have no other disease that the primary treatment is prayer, confession, and meeting. And we have no other disease.
The AA model.
Yeah, exactly, which is 80% of our addiction treatment. And we have no other disease where it's criminal to engage in the behavior that's necessary to have that disease if your drug is illegal. So the disease model, in the context of criminalization, which is designed to create stigma, cannot really destigmatize addiction.
In describing addiction as a learning disability, you give the analogy of someone with OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder, pointing out that nobody thinks there's something special about soap that makes them a compulsive hand washer. So why do we see drugs in that way? But is that a good analogy? Soap is an addictive.
Yes, but virtually anything can be addictive. And addiction occurs in the relationship between a person and a behavior or a drug. 80% of people who try even drugs like heroin do not get addicted. And so we have to ask, what is different about the people who do?
And so what is this learning disorder hypothesis?
So the idea is you can't have addiction without learning. Addiction is basically a form of pathological learning in which you learn that the drug solves your problems. If you don't learn this, you wouldn't know what to crave, so you couldn't be addicted. So learning is necessary to it, but the learning that happens is pathological. And it's basically as though your brain has fallen in love with a drug rather than a person. And falling in love completely changes your priorities. It makes a lot of people do a lot of really weird stuff. And if you're having an illicit affair, you do a lot of the same things that you would do, like lying, et cetera, in relation to illicit drug use.
And so are there treatments for learning disorders as we generally identify them that might be applicable to addiction?
Yes, I think so, because what we've been doing wrong with addiction is defined as compulsive behavior despite negative consequences. So if negative consequences fixed it, it wouldn't exist. Negative consequences is just another word for punishment, and we've been using punishment for the last 100 years to try to stop a problem that's defined by its resistance to punishment. So, you know, no excellent schools beat children. No excellent schools use humiliation and attacks to try to have kids learn. We recognize that people learn best in a climate of empathy and respect where they want to please the teacher and they want to learn. And we need to bring this kind of a climate into the addiction treatment system.
But we don't just punish drugs anymore. We treat drugs, right? We have treat addiction, I should say. We have recovery. You mentioned the AA model derisively before, but we don't just punish.
No, that is certainly true. And I am not saying that the 12-step model is bad as a self-help group. I am not saying that it doesn't help a lot of people who voluntarily affiliate with it as a self-help group. My problem with the 12-step programs is when you are made to pay $1,000 a day for what you can get for free in a church basement. You can't get the other treatments for free in a church basement. So why isn't our professional system reserved for professional treatment? We don't have any other disease or disorder that we treat by indoctrinating people into a self-help group. And so while I certainly think that it is absolutely fine to recommend that people attend 12-step groups, and I think that the social support that these groups provide is enormously helpful and was enormously helpful to me. I just think that the idea of this as the one true way and as something you should pay for violates AA's own traditions and is also not helpful to taxpayers and insurers who should be paying for stuff that they can't get for free.
My guest is addiction expert and journalist Maya Salovitz. Her new book is Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction, understanding it kind of as a learning disorder. And listeners, you can call with your experiences. You can call with your questions. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And I think we could say this book is framed in part through your personal story. And the first drug you took was Ritalin at 3 years old. The last drug you took was heroin shortly after being expelled from college. The Ritalin is interesting because isn't that something that's used to treat a learning disorder, if that's what we consider ADHD to be?
Well, yes. And I was only on it for several months. I actually have no conscious memory of being on it. But I was 3 years old, and this was 1968. We were not medicating children at that time. Today, I would have been diagnosed with Asperger's or, you know, some form of autism spectrum disorder. Then the only thing they could come up with was ADHD and emotional lability and a kid who's reading at three. So I had a lot going on. And I think, you know, you could argue that that early exposure to the substance changed my brain and predisposed me, but there's no data that supports that position. I think what really happened was the oversensitivity, the difficulty socializing, the difficulty connecting was what predisposed me. And so, you know, when I was a sort of aspie little kid, I was obsessed with opera and science fiction, and I went on and on and on about it, which did not make me many friends. But when I went on and on and on about drugs, suddenly people were interested. And so this sort of really got me into that world.
Steve in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Steve.
Good morning, Brian. It's been ages. I've been trying to speak with you and your group, and today I finally did it. I did 4 years plus at a substance abuse rehabilitation facility. And one of the things I always had a problem with was the high recidivism rate. And it's not that these individuals...
You were, just to be clear, it sounds like you worked at a substance abuse rehab facility. You weren't a client.
I'm not a client. I was a social worker there.
Got it.
And I had clients there. And a number of them that came back because of the recidivism rate, I always said to them, I said, maybe you're back because you missed a point that you didn't get the first time. But the problem I always noticed is that it was much easier for them to continue because of, you know, triggers, and they didn't get a handle on how to control it. And it was more of a situation of being able to say, I don't want to do it, and control themselves.
Thank you very much. And some version of that, I'm not sure exactly what he was going for there, but some version of that often comes up in these conversations, that you can have all the rehab techniques in the world, but a person is going to get clean and relatively stay clean when they're ready.
Yes, and this is why learning, again, is so important. You can't teach somebody something they don't want to learn. And so when learning works best is when you attract people to things. I mean, our addiction treatment system has just tried to pound people over the head to force them in with arrests and make them comply. Instead, when you're trying to sell a product, that is not what you do. You don't have the government force everybody into buying your product and still make a lousy product. What you need to do is create a treatment system that is attractive, empathic, and respectful, and that recognizes that people use drugs for reasons. And people who become addicted, two-thirds of them have had some kind of extreme childhood trauma. At least half of them have a psychiatric condition, you know, ranging from depression to schizophrenia. So if we don't deal with the underlying reasons why people are vulnerable to addiction, then it's not surprising that people are not going to stop. And I mean, if you think about it in comparison with love, you know, if you see that old picture of your old, you know, your first love, you still bring all those memories come back, all, you know, all that feeling comes back. And so, you know, if we think about it that way, it's a much more hopeful way, because most people do get over breakups. Most people, you know, do move past these things.
David in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hello?
Hi, David. You're on the air.
Good morning. Sorry, I had you on speakerphone while I was listening.
That's okay.
So I find fault with the basic premise that addiction is acquired through learning. And I'm basing this strictly on my own experience. So my experience was that I started using and abusing marijuana as my first drug of choice when I was around 13 years old. And I was instantly, or virtually instantly, abusing it compulsively. I just, if I had some pot, I would smoke it as soon as I got up in the morning, and I smoked it all day long. And over the years, I attempted to stop using or abusing marijuana, and I quickly discovered that if I stopped abusing marijuana, that I would abuse alcohol and cocaine and other drugs, because I just have a I'm just one of those people that is not able to use normally, as they say. With reference to the comment about AA, I'm not sure what type of treatment you were referring to, where you say that people are charged a lot of money, but none of the 12-step programs that I've been involved with, which are principally AA, charge anything.
I'm talking about programs like Hazelden and Betty Ford and all of the for-profit treatment centers or nonprofits. Some of those are nonprofits that charge money as if the person was hospitalized. I think that a lot of very well-intentioned people do a lot of really good work in those programs, but I really think that 12-step content, which you can get for free at a 12-step meeting, should not be the content of paid treatment that your insurer or the government pays for.
Because of its religious connection or for some other reason?
Well, there's the religious connection. There's also the case that there's this idea of powerlessness that is imposed on people. There's this idea that you must hit bottom, that has been used to humiliate and attack and do terrible things to people in order to force them to the bottom. That's not to say that people do not find relief in 12-step programs. It's just that the data shows that this is not the one true way. There is no one true way. Addiction is as different in people as any other condition.
So you're not questioning that something might have worked for David and trying to get rid of that model, you're just saying there should be more models.
Well, yes, and I'm saying that, you know, in medical care, we provide treatment that is based on the evidence of what works. And we don't require prayer, and we don't have a moral approach. You know, in the 12 steps, you are supposed to find a higher power. You are supposed to confess. You are supposed to make restitution. And all of those things can be very helpful as spiritual practices. I'm not saying that they can't be. But what I am saying is that that isn't what you get when you go for cancer treatment.
David, thank you for your call. When we've talked before, it's been about your advocacy for the harm reduction approach to people with addiction, which is to say, you can't just say no to drugs. You can't tell everybody that because you have a tendency to overuse, you shouldn't or even have been horribly addicted and close to death or however we want to describe it, individual circumstances on drugs, that the only solution is to say no drugs for you ever. I know personally recovering alcoholics who are in different categories of this. One friend of mine who will never touch another drink after he was an alcoholic early in his adulthood.
Yes.
And another one who was an alcoholic early in his adulthood and has gotten to the point where he can be a mild social drinker. So people are different. And your point is to look at it through the lens of harm reduction, which could mean things like, I guess the thing they're talking about today is supervised injection facilities.
Yes.
To reduce the harm of using heroin, if people are using heroin, rather than just say, don't use heroin, period. Does that relate to your book and this theory of looking at addiction as a learning disorder rather than a disease?
Absolutely, because what harm reduction does is it teaches people healthier ways of living and healthier ways of interacting with drugs. Some people are so traumatized and so, you know, desperate that they cannot give up the thing that allows them to cope and the thing that makes their life bearable before you put the other things in place that are going to help them. So they're going to continue using, you want to teach them so that they stay alive. I mean, one of the things, we're having this opioid epidemic right now, and one of the things that is really tragic is that we know that sustained maintenance with buprenorphine or methadone, indefinite treatment, possibly lifelong, is the only thing that has been proven to cut the death rate by 50%. And we have not expanded this anywhere near as much as we should be doing, in part because we have such an ideological picture of what treatment should be. And we think that if you have any substance in your body, you shouldn't be considered in recovery. So I just want to be ecumenical. And I think that in harm reduction, one of the most beautiful things about it is that when a person comes in, they're often really marginalized, they're self-hating, they may be homeless, they have a whole slew of problems. And what you say to them in a safe injection facility or in a needle exchange or these other harm reduction things is, I believe you deserve to live regardless of if I disapprove of what you're doing. I think your life has value. And what that does is it helps people to see, well, maybe my life does have value. Maybe I can do other things. You know, maybe this isn't the only thing that I can do. And, you know, maybe these people know something. And maybe someday I could even help people like me. So I think that, you know, these things are, they seem to be in opposition, but they aren't necessarily. We should have all kinds of pathways to treatment available. I sometimes sound especially harsh about the 12-step programs only because it's 80% of what we have and it shouldn't be. That doesn't mean that people shouldn't go out and go to meetings and get the social support that they need.
And we leave it there with journalist and addiction expert Maya Salovitz. Her new book is called Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Vijay Seshadri next. Stay with us.